Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Dave Margosian, and we are going to be discussing Spin by Robert Charles Wilson, which won the 2006 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So, Dave, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for being flexible with scheduling, because this one was a little tough with all the upset in the world and my having a difficult time figuring out how to get reading done in quarantine conditions.
Well, I don't have that problem. I've got nothing but time, as it turns out. So I'm okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's not really strict quarantine, right? I can leave the house, but the difference for me is that my routine is different.
And right. Exactly. So, same here.
Yeah. My routine tends to include reading at lunchtime and, you know, reading on the way into my building and that kind of stuff. And so when I'm at home, I'm much more likely to get interrupted by my wife or my son or my dogs. And so I'm just figuring out how to structure some time in there and say, you know what, I'm going to read from this time to this time. So,
well, you got
to
make time where you can, right?
You do. So let's talk about you a little bit. You mentioned in our emails back and forth that you have done some podcasting.
Yeah, a little bit. I was with Sci-Fi for Me for a little while there, covering like the DC superhero shows.
And
I've done some zombie voices for the Talking Dead podcast, which they, basically what they do is they say, well, here's the title of the episode and you record it and we use it in the show. So
nice. I have to admit, I'm a little bit behind on The Walking Dead. It stopped being appointment television.
Yeah,
for me.
Don't bother.
I figured when the most recent season drops on Netflix, I'll go back and catch up.
If you're a diehard fan, go for it. But I mean, really, I think most people have sort of given up at this point.
Yep. Well, so let's talk about your history as a science fiction fan.
Boy, I think right out of the crib. I just remember when I was a kid, my dad would let us watch movies like 2001, Planet of the Apes, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And we would sit in the living room and we would all watch this together as a family. So I think that got me sort of interested. And it's always been sort of peripheral for me in terms of books and things like that. And then, of course, you know, Star Wars came along and that just opened up the floodgates.
Yeah.
And then it's just been a matter of reading this whole time, not exclusively science fiction, but I'd say probably primarily 90% science fiction.
Okay. So I guess it sounds like you're saying you were kind of more on the movie and television side at first, and you've moved more into books?
Yeah, because as you find them, it's like, oh, hey, this looks like something that I've seen. You know, let me go with that. Because it might be interesting, you know. It's like you say, it's about the ideas, you know. You're always searching for that next perfect read that you want to just get your fingernails dirty under, you know. So that's always been a goal for me.
Cool. Well, so why this book in particular?
I have been a Robert Charles Wilson fan probably from the beginning, I would think. I've read all of his books at this point. But this one was something really special, and I can see definitely why it won the Hugo Award that year. But that one to me, it just caught me the right way. I mean, up until that point, I had almost given up on reading Wilson's books because there were a couple that just didn't quite go for me prior to this. And then I read this and I was just like, oh, got to go back and get them all in hardcover now. And, you know, just to get a hardcover copy of Spin and everything. It's just, to me, it's his best book.
Okay. So now this is my only experience, as far as I know, with Robert Charles Wilson. What else do you know about him? I mean, like, are there other books of his that you'd recommend?
I would recommend almost anything. But like all authors, you know, you kind of hit and miss. I would say definitely A Bridge of Years would be another one I would recommend. The last year was one that I read maybe a year or two ago that sticks in my brain. But nothing really hits like Spin does. That just got me so excited over it and everything that I just wanted to, you know, keep going and get involved with it more.
Well, I'll definitely ask you about the sequels to it later on.
Okay.
All right. So let's go ahead and move into like our non-spoiler discussion. We'll keep it fairly light on spoilers. I feel like this one, it's tough to talk about the main plot without some kind of spoiler, but when it's the kind of thing that happens in the first chapter, I'm not sure that it can be really considered a spoiler.
It kind of doesn't though, really, because it almost starts in the middle of the book, you know, where they're
that's true
fleeing to Indonesia or wherever they are, they happen to be at that point.
Yeah, yeah. I get it mixed up because with the two timelines in the book, I forgot that it starts on the future timeline.
Right. Like I said, it started for me sort of in the middle, and then it goes starts doing these backflashes, and then it sort of the backflashes catch up to the beginning of the story as it goes along, and finally they sort of merge at the end. But there's always, you know, they're always going back to their childhoods and whatnot.
Right. Well, so with that in mind, can you give a quick non-spoiler synopsis, elevator pitch kind of thing for this book?
Sure. I would say it's probably one day the Earth was captured in an alien force field that basically blotted out all the stars and sent time spinning around them at a much faster rate.
Nice. And then things happen.
Yeah, pretty much.
No, that's good.
Well, you sort of follow the story through the three kids. There's Tyler Dupree and his friends, the twins, Diane and
Jason.
Jason, thank you. I kept thinking Simon, and that's not right.
No.
And as you go through this, you sort of discover the things that are happening to them while this is sort of going on. And as time goes on, you find out more and more and more and more about what the purpose of this force field is and why it's there and, you know, how they're basically doing the science thing, you know, like in The Martian, you know, the line is, I'm going to science the shit out of it.
Right.
So that's what they do. I mean, Jason basically builds a company that is focused on the spin, as it is called. And that they do everything in their power to keep the Earth protected from the oncoming destruction of the sun, which is, I mean, as time goes by, millions of years in a day outside, the sun is, of course, growing older and older and older. And as we all know by reading science fiction, eventually it's going to, you know, explode, go nova. Their struggle is to make sure that they can live through it and figure out what the heck's going on.
Right. Right. And along the way, you kind of have the two sides of it almost represented by Jason and Diane. Wait, are they the Lawsons? Is that what it is?
Yes.
Okay. Where you have Jason, who's the very analytical scientific side, and Diane, who's the more philosophical religious side. And so she falls in with a apocalyptic cult, more or less.
Right.
And so that's kind of fascinating to see both what's the implication for general life on Earth and how does it affect society as well?
Right. They don't really go into society as much.
No.
I think it's just in terms of their immediate group, I guess. They cover a lot of the religious aspects of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which I always enjoy.
It's interesting that because Wilson is usually pretty good at representing both sides of the religious coin in most of his books. You've got the people who are sort of fanatical and the other people who are, you know, they're just regular folks. They go to church every Sunday, but they don't, you know, they don't beat you over the head or try to convert you as they're talking to you.
Right.
You know, that sort of thing. You know, there's more of a calm, collected aspect of it. And I think that with Diane, while she's sort of in that cult, she's primarily there for her husband, Simon, and not really for any sort of religious satisfaction, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So just in terms of kind of general thoughts on this one, I will say this is a first time read for me, and it's really, really enjoyable.
Oh, I'm good. I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, it is longer than it felt like in terms of the page count. Like it's a much quicker read than it being, you know, 400 plus pages would indicate. And, you know, the opposite can be true. And so I was delighted with that.
Yeah.
Because once I started getting into really reading it, then, you know, I did find that it was briskly paced. And part of that, I think, is the having the parallel narratives of the future timeline and then the flashbacks kind of leading up where I'm going, how are we going to get to there?
You know, right.
And that kept me turning the page.
That's one of Wilson's real geniuses is that he can get you involved with what's going on in the chapter and then leave you hanging with a cliffhanger at the end of the chapter. And then he switches to another point of view in the next chapter. So you have to read through that in order to get to what you want to get to. But it's still, once you get to the end of that chapter, then you're like, oh, now I get to find out what happens to these people. But I want to go back and find out what happens, you know, in the last chapter too. So it keeps you going, which is probably why it seemed like a much faster read. It gets you involved and it basically carries you away.
Yeah. I mean, it's a tightrope walk because anytime you do plot and subplot kind of thing, if one of them is not working for you, then that it can turn an otherwise enjoyable book into a slog. But in this case, I found both of the timelines interesting enough to keep me going.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it was just starting that first chapter and it showing what year it was. And I was like, wait, what? You know, lots of times you have a book or a movie that, you know, shows an opening scene then it says, you know, 5 years earlier or 2 days earlier or something. But it's not like 4 billion years earlier.
Right. But if you go back now and start reading again, reading it again, the first chapter will make more sense because you've gone through the whole rest of the book and all the things that he's alluding to are, you know, you know what he's talking about at this point, and it's just like, oh, okay, now it makes more sense.
Right. Yeah. I literally read it just a couple hours ago, which is funny because it just a couple minutes ago when we were talking about it, I forgot that was the first chapter again.
That's okay. I forgot about a lot of things until I reread it. And then,
Then
I was like, oh yeah, I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was nice to have gone through it again.
Yeah. Agreed. So if you were going to recommend this novel to people, what can you think of any comps for it?
You know, it's kind of tough because it's such an original story, I guess. The first things that I thought of were if you read Ender's Game and you liked the dynamic between Ender and Valentine and his brother as kids, it sort of reflects that a little bit. But it doesn't go into the same sort of areas that Ender's Game does. It just kind of starts out the same way.
Right.
I would say if it's probably closest to anything in terms of the Hugo winners, I would say more like Childhood's End, because of
which isn't actually a Hugo winner.
It's a retro Hugo winner, isn't it?
Nope.
I think it. No. Oh, I'm sorry. I misread that information. Okay. Well, wouldn't be the first time. I guess the point I'm trying to make is that with Childhood's End, it's a setup for the advancement of humanity in terms of species.
Right.
Which
definitely.
And I won't go into, you know, we won't go into that whole thing yet. But the other thing that I thought of was Arrival, because there are these huge alien presences that you have to kind of figure out as you go along. But I've been noticing a lot lately that there are a lot of books that are getting compared to that. So,
So I had a couple that I had written down.
Go for it.
All mine are movies or television. So the thing that I'm seeing as similar in these is the time skew between Earth and outside the Earth. And so that one, I'm reminded of the old Outer Limits episode, Wolf 359, where they essentially create an Earth in a lab, and it's evolving on an accelerated rate. And so they can zoom in on it with their microscopes and see civilizations rising and falling. and they're wanting to see, you know, well, wait, what happens when this gets to beyond us? Can we see into our future by looking at this?
Right.
And that was one idea. And then another one, Love, Death, and Robots, the Netflix series, had a very similarly themed episode, only it was taking place in someone's freezer in an episode called Ice Age. And it's one of the only episodes of Love, Death, and Robots that has a live action component, because it has Topher Grace and Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who are the, you know, the live action element, and it's in their freezer where they're seeing the all so this
they're
happen.
They're looking in their freezer.
Yep.
To see all of this stuff. Is that kind of like the Simpsons episode where she builds a city and people start growing? And
wow, I don't remember that one.
No,
I'm sure I've seen it.
But it's one of the Halloween episodes. She's got a science project and Bart spills something on it. And all of a sudden there's Protestants growing in her Petri dish. Lutherans. I'm sorry. It was Lutherans.
Okay.
No offense to anybody out there. So,
right. Lisa's Tub Universe. Sorry, I had to. So for the record, this is Treehouse of Horror 7, if anybody wants to look that one up.
Well, I'll have to go back and look at Love and Death and Robots. I watched a couple of episodes, but I just haven't been able to get around to the rest of it yet. So I'll keep my eyes peeled for that one.
Yep. And then the last one that I had was Interstellar, just because there's that that point where they're at the planet that's really, really close to the black hole. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they go down for a couple of hours back on their ship. You know, the person who waited behind has been waiting for them for 23 years or something like that.
Okay. That makes sense. I have yet to see Interstellar.
Sorry, spoilers if you haven't seen it. Sorry.
No, that's okay. I mean, I've heard enough about it to get the gist of what the story is, but haven't watched it entirely.
It's actually my least favorite Christopher Nolan movie, but I still like it.
Okay. And can I ask what your favorite Christopher Nolan movie is?
It's The Prestige.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I like that one too.
Love that one.
I liked it so much, it made me want to read the book. So,
I recommend that. And, you know, for anybody listening, if you want to,
definitely,
we did an episode on that for Take Me to Your Reader. So
there you go.
I'm trying to think if there's anything, is there anything else you want to talk about before we get to spoilers?
I don't think so. It's like you said, you have to almost get into the spoiler area before you can really start getting into the nitty gritty of it.
Totally agree. Okay, let's do it. Spoiler talk. So anything you want to bring up, you know, I know you've read this one more than one time. You said you had written down a bunch of stuff and I have a few notes, but let's bounce off whatever you want to talk about.
Okay. So the first thing that was a kind of a surprise to me was the advent of the Martians.
Yes.
And again, this is the point I wanted to make about Wilson's writing. He's got a certain number of science fiction tropes in this book. There's time travel, there's terraforming, there's aliens, you know, all these things. But he doesn't take the normal routes that you would normally think to get to these sort of topics. He's got original ideas in terms of all of this. But at any rate, what Jason and his company does is to try to establish human beings on another planet. They shoot terraforming rockets out past the spin bubble onto Mars. And therein, because time is passing so much faster in Mars or on Mars, this society develops, a human / Martian society sort of grows there. And, you know, I forget what it was, but it was kind of like a matter of days almost.
Right.
And then the Martian ambassador comes to Earth and says, oh, you know, we got all this, we got all these great medicines that you can use and that'll help you and all that fun stuff. So,
right.
That was one thing that I had completely forgotten about. And it was kind of a nice surprise that when I got to it, I was like, oh yeah. Okay, cool.
Oh, the notion of the fourths?
And not that so much as when the Martian ambassador showed up. I was like, oh.
Okay.
Yeah, I had completely forgotten about it.
Yeah. One Engo Win, which is an interesting name.
It was so sad to see him go and how he died, it was like, oh my God. The thing with the shoes, it's like, boy.
Yep.
You know, it's just, oh, it's so sad.
Yeah. You know, humans and their guns, right?
Well, yeah,
I love the idea of being able to more or less have instantaneous results for all these missions that they do. Because as you alluded to, right, they're trying to terraform Mars. And the first thing you have to do is make it suitable for terraforming. And so they're doing things to try to warm it up and add bacteria and water and all that kind of stuff.
And plant life. And yeah.
Yeah.
I read somewhere, I think Book Rags was the place I found it. They were talking about how they had sent some volunteers out to Mars to colonize it and get it all set up. And I don't remember that being a thing in the book at all. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
there were groups of people who were sent up there. And, you know, the idea was they could end up, you know, vastly distant from the supplies that were sent. You know,
right.
Things could end up showing up decades or even centuries later.
Right. Yeah. Which is how you get, you know, little black men. And I mean, literally black, not African-American. I don't want anybody to get the wrong impression. But he's literally an ivory color or a
ebony. There we go.
Ebony. Yes.
No, it's interesting too, that, the civilization on Mars ends up being much more ancient than the civilization on Earth from an actual relative time, where, you know, we have had civilization a few thousand years, right? But they, by the time, Wan and Go Wen ends up coming to Earth, they've had a civilization going there for 100,000 years.
Right. It's almost in a way a reflection of the Martian Chronicles, because when the humans get to Mars, the Martians have basically died off at that point. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing I forgot.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's a good thing to springboard off of, about the notion that the universe is so vast that civilizations rise and fall prior to being able to bridge the distances to actually interact. And so the idea that the hypotheticals are trying to kind of sync everybody up so that there can be more than one intelligent species available and able to communicate with each other before they start, you know, their natural senescence.
Right. Yeah. Good point. That's one of the things that I really liked about the book, was the fact that you really don't get a positive sense as to what the hypotheticals are or why they're doing what they're doing.
Right.
They just kind of like, okay. And to be honest, I don't remember, getting old again. I don't remember what the sequels, get into as far as that goes. Because I'm rereading all of Wilson's stuff right now, I'll be getting back into those a little bit, and hopefully I'll have a better time with it than I did the first time I read them.
Okay. Well, that saved me a question for later on then.
Oh, sorry.
No worries. I wondered, when you kind of got Jason's last monologue, kind of where he was talking to Tyler prior to his death, where he had figured out what the hypotheticals were, right? Because it's a weird name for aliens, right? It's
like, right.
Okay, this thing has happened. It has to be technological. So there have to be aliens that have done this. And so they just started calling them the hypotheticals, because they didn't. I mean, in a way, it's a good name, right? It's because we know that there has to be somebody there who's done this. We just don't know anything about them at all.
Right.
And so, but then Jason had figured out that they were a bunch of, what were the names of those small machines that they sent out into the world reproduce themselves? I know that they called them von Neumann machines at some point. Replicators. I think they just call them replicators.
Okay.
Essentially like nanotechnology, but on a macro scale, where they're not tiny. They're only tiny in relation to, you know, everyday objects.
Right.
Or, you know, planetary bodies and that kind of stuff, where they sent them out there, and the mission was go out, find raw materials, reproduce yourselves, and do an inventory of the surrounding you know, solar systems and, you know, map the galaxy as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And the only reason that this can work is because the way the spin works with the time skew, so right. that they've got millions and millions of years to go out there and do that investigation and send data back. And that's what Jason was then consuming and determined. I believe he determined that the hypotheticals actually were basically these replicators, and they were almost like, you know, Borg nanites or something from Star Trek, where they had a hive mind rather than an individual mind. And that they were in observing the universe, they kept seeing that civilizations would pop up and then flame out, pop up and then flame out. And mm-hmm. so then they started, because this is where something comes into the book, where here we've seeded the civilization on Mars and everything seems to be going well. And oops, now they have a spin membrane as well.
Right, right. You'll have to forgive me.
Which that was a pretty crazy turn in the book.
Yeah. I hope you'll forgive me. I read it a couple of months ago, and it's really not that fresh in my mind. And as I've stated a number of times already, that my brain is ancient.
So. Yeah. Well, and it's partially my fault, because I kicked us down the road a month because I wasn't able to.
Oh, no worries.
To get this one read. So.
Yeah. I don't remember everything that I read. I usually just remember, I remember this being good. And that's enough to make me reread it. So, mm-hmm. but
one of the things that I always like to see when talking about Mars and terraforming of Mars is I want to have some kind of mention of the Martian magnetic field and how they're going to overcome the issue of Mars not having much of a magnetic field, because that's critical to keeping an atmosphere. Because stellar radiation and solar wind and that kind of stuff is just going to blow an atmosphere right off of Mars unless there's some way to restore the magnetic field, whether it's spinning up the core again or whether it's some kind of artificial magnetic field. Mm-hmm. I was hoping to see something like that here, and I didn't. But it's a nitpicky thing that I guess only nerds care about.
I almost would have thought that they would have thought of that. Jason would have thought of that in terms of terraforming. I seem to remember they were talking about planting trees and doing things like that to the point where it could generate its own atmosphere.
Right. Yep. Well, like I said, anything that you have written down that you wanted to talk about, I think you mentioned you had taken quite a few notes, right?
Well, I've sort of run through them all at this point.
Okay. I have a couple others.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Do you, and I'm asking you to recall stuff when you've just said that the recall may not be the greatest.
Uh-oh.
Do you remember why it was called the spin? I don't remember in particular why that name was attached to it.
I think it just was the name that they came up with.
Okay.
Whether it was just one of those sort of catchphrases that they implemented, or I never really got a sense of anything really spinning other than time and space around
right.
the force field.
When I think about it, where if the spin membrane were transparent, right, then that's the sky would look like it was spinning. But just because of the time slip, right? You just see the stars. The stars would just be a blur.
Yeah. Well, the whole thing was that the membrane blocked out the stars and the moon, so that it was one of those things where it's like, do you remember where you were when the stars went out? And when they actually do come back, that's when they know something big is going down. So
yeah, that was a pretty crazy moment in the book when the membrane disappeared or became transparent anyway, and they got to see, you know, the aging red sun, more or less.
Yeah.
And experienced that just for a couple of days, I think it was.
Yeah.
Much longer, that would have been pretty disastrous for people on Earth.
Again, that they knew that this was sort of coming, and they were like, let's see what we can do about this. Hence, that's why Jason decided to terraform Mars with the human DNA and basically try to keep the human species in the galaxy.
Yeah, just the ticking clock, right? Where they find out early on things are going fast enough outside of the spin membrane here that we realistically have about 50 years before, even if we were able to get the spin membrane to disappear.
Yes.
That would be a disaster for us, because it would be the only thing protecting us at that point.
Right. Because as the sun is expanding, it's also heading towards Earth. So it's going to get worse. And then, then the UV rays will just wipe us all out.
Yep. And so moving humanity to Mars is really just a stopgap kind of thing, right? Where we'll move out that way until we can figure out something better to do.
Right.
And, you know, it turns out that the hypotheticals had thought it through, and there was a reason that they dropped the shields right there for a couple of days so they could move the arch in, which that's, like you mentioned, it's mentioned in that first chapter, but then we don't know anything about it until, you know, three quarters of the way through the book that all of a sudden there's these more or less stargates, right?
Right. Right.
And I love the science fiction there where they only work if you pass through them in the right direction. I can't remember what all the details were, but like the ocean passes through it, but it doesn't actually mix with the, you know, the ocean on another world. The air doesn't, you know, you don't end up with like enormous winds around it because the atmospheres are at different pressures or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It has to be like powered vehicles being piloted by people.
Yeah.
So like a bird won't accidentally fly through.
Oh, see, now I thought I remember reading something about a seagull going through that, didn't seem to affect it, but
yeah, it flew through it and it didn't. And you know, it's essentially just like it's the St. Louis Arch, right? Where you're passing through it and it doesn't take you anywhere.
Right. Right.
I'm sure lots of people have been disappointed going through that one, hoping it would be a gateway to somewhere else.
Yeah. I don't know if anybody was affected that way, but hey, this looks like the arch in St. Louis. Let's go down there.
Right.
We read this book and we decided to go.
So, like I mentioned, I mean, as a person of faith myself, I always like when a science fiction author thinks through, you know, what would happen with the religions of Earth, you know, based on contact with aliens or anything. That's you know, I like a book like Childhood's End for that reason. Mm-hmm. I don't love the way Clark treats it because I feel like it's a little too pat. but I really do like it here where any kind of event like this, where it's putting a clock on the survival of the Earth, is going to bring out the millennialists and the, you know, the the rapture people and the
and the red,
the apocalyptic cults, right?
The red calf people and the
This is now I think at least the second book among the Hugo winners that had a plot involving a red heifer, because the Yiddish Policemen's Union had that as well.
Okay. Maybe it's just one of those things, you know, if it's got a red calf in it, Hugo Board goes for it, you know?
Maybe. Well, or, I mean, I wouldn't call it low hanging fruit because I'm sure that people who did not grow up churched at all would have no idea. Well, what's the red heifer stuff where mm-hmm. me growing up in the church I did that was really into prophecy and the end times and that kind of stuff and scaring the crap out of kids. That, you know, I recognize it immediately. I'm like, oh, okay, that's from those old books my mom used to read.
Yeah, again, as I stated before, Wilson tends to include religious characters in his books. And he always shows, I don't know if a positive side of the characters is the right term, but he doesn't criticize. You know, he just uses the character's religion in terms of the circumstances and their surroundings. And mm-hmm. it also helps you get a little bit more of an understanding as to some of the other religions of the world, which is nice.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say that he was particularly kind to the religious cults, you know, but it was through character viewpoint where if there was any criticism of them, right, the fact that these apocalyptic cults were, you know, big sex romps and, you know, orgies and stuff. Mm-hmm. That's a little askew from your conservative American Christianity of today.
Yeah. But,
the fact is that, Diane almost dies because she catches this animal born pathogen.
Yeah. What is it? CVWS, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. See, there you go.
Yeah.
Mind like a steel trap.
A rusty steel trap, maybe. No, I just looked at my notes. Sorry.
There we go. Yeah. Where, you know, she would have died and there's some, you know, there's, you know, Scientology and Christian Science and some other, I think even Jehovah's Witnesses don't like things like blood transfusions. And so that's the kind of stuff that I feel like it's fair game to criticize people's religions about when they're denying medical science.
Yeah.
But there's plenty of non-religious people who deny medical science too. So,
That's true. It's a great book to read, especially in these days, because, you know, it's basically, well, we got COVID-19. It could be worse. Yeah. You know, he could be dying of this mad cow disease, or maybe, you know, being thrown into the sun or something. So, you know, always look at the bright side, as Eric Idle says.
Right. Yeah. I thought the notion that the Martians had figured out a way to give you a kind of a fourth stage of life, where on Earth we have childhood, adolescence, and adulthood, right? And where they've added a fourth one through their medical technology, but it alters you in a fundamental way, right? And makes you into kind of a different person. You have some different instincts, and I thought that was an interesting thread to pull on that didn't get a lot of pulling done on it. And so I'm curious if that's followed up in the other books.
Honestly, I don't remember. I haven't gotten around to rereading them, but I'll get there eventually.
All right. You'll have to let me know.
Now, the whole thing with the other two books is it takes place on the new planet with a new bunch of characters. So I was kind of disappointed by that, because I was so involved with Tyler and Diane, and I wanted to see what happened to them. And when it didn't go that way, is why I don't remember a whole lot about them. But again, I have to reread them. So it's been probably since the years that they came out, what, 2007, 2008, somewhere around there.
Yeah, somewhere in there.
So, Rusty Steel Trap.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of my listeners may chime in and let us know how those other books are.
At one point, Sci-Fi was supposed to make a miniseries out of it. And there are still web pages up that say, oh, you know, Sci-Fi is going to make this miniseries out of Spin, blah, blah, blah. And you never see anything beyond that, unfortunately. A lot of the comments in the comments section of those news stories say, you know, hey, whatever happened to this? And as far as I can tell, it looks like maybe the French did some sort of a thing like that. I saw a video on YouTube where it was essentially the part where Simon, Diane, and Tyler are driving back to Jason and Diane's parents' house to give her the drug and make sure she's okay. And at the point where Simon leaves, it's the big argument between the three of them as Diane is, you know, lying there dying. That's what it looked like to me. It could have been something completely different, but the description on the YouTube videos that made it sound like that's what it was.
Okay. Well, if you dig that up, I'd be curious to check that out.
I'll see if I can dig it up again. I'll shoot you the link for that.
Sounds good. The last thing I saw, I was looking at the Wikipedia entry for Spin the other day, and last I saw it was like 2015 that there was an announcement that they were developing the miniseries. But I feel like 5 years is long enough that makes me think they've abandoned it.
Yeah, well, Sci-Fi talks about a lot of things that they're gonna do, but they don't always follow through. And it can't take that long to develop these properties, really. I think Ringworld was another one that they were supposed to have done by now, and they still haven't, much to my disappointment. Because, you're always on the lookout for good adaptations, even for, you know, books that may not be that good or as well-known as, well, say Ringworld is probably more well-known than Spin is, I think, at this point. But, I wish they'd have gotten that off the ground, too. I would have liked to have seen that.
Yeah. I have to say I was a little intrigued when Tyler and Diane transited the Arch and they sprinkled Jason's ashes. Kind of the idea was to do it kind of in the space between the worlds. I was interested to know if, you know, the hypotheticals had somehow transformed him into some kind of nanotechnology and we were going to, you know, see him come back in some way or see his influence some way when his ashes were scattered, that somehow there'd be a bunch of, you know, nano machines or something. But
they did it between the two different worlds, didn't they?
Yeah.
Part on Earth and part on whatever the other planet's called. I forget. So I don't know. I kind of doubt it.
Yeah, I do too. But it was an idle thought that I had after, you know, as they were doing it.
That could be interesting.
Because they had been kind of reprogramming him.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were some interesting physical changes taking place where he was blind, but, and his eyes seemed to be made of, you know, crystals or something.
Right. Well, I was sort of under the impression that the crystal eyes and everything was part of the Martian drug. But again, I don't remember the exact details as to what was right. going on that one.
The difference was there, it's kind of like the DNA that the changes that take place to get you to be a fourth are a platform for further like software upgrades almost. And Jason had started upgrading, you know, patching himself. So he was
okay.
Point something else. And then at that point, once you've done that, then it adds some kind of communication with the hypotheticals in some way. Cause that's, I got the impression that's how he got some of his information.
Okay. Your hypothesis could be true. And again, I don't remember the sequels very well, so
I'm just going to have to read the Wikipedia entries for them.
There you go.
Since they're not on the Hugo winners list, I probably won't be able to get to them. So,
well, that's one of my missions, so I'll get back to you on that.
Okay. Alrighty. Anything else you want to bring up, or we can move into final thoughts?
Not really. I think I covered all the ground of all my notes and whatnot. I just wanted to once again encourage your readers to, even if I've made this sound like the worst possible book on the earth, just give it a try because it's so good. I just can't say enough good things about it. And the more I reread it, the more I'll remember mm-hmm. and the better it'll become.
Right.
So. See, I had made the mistake of rereading the book back in January when I thought we would be a little closer to recording. So, but I listened to the audiobook twice.
Okay.
Still nice. Didn't matter.
Understood. Cool. Yeah. So I would say, you know, I found this one very enjoyable. I'll be curious to see where it ranks when I start, when I go in there and put it up against other stuff. It's sometimes recency bias puts stuff up a little further than it probably should be. And then later on I move it down. But, so I'm glad you suggested it.
Well, like I said, it's one of my favorites. I mean, I work at a bookstore, so I have a set handful of books that I like to recommend. Of course, I got to make sure that they're in stock to be able to do that. But
right.
You know, Spin is one of those when it was more readily available. I was just like, always like, oh yeah, go with this one. This is the bee's knees or the Martian's knees, whatever.
Yeah.
So I'm always in the sci-fi section, you know?
Well, I think that probably suffices for final thoughts. It's a strong recommend from both of us.
Yes.
So Dave, I really want to thank you for doing this and for being flexible because I think you originally reached out to me in October and now we're recording in April.
was it that long ago? Oh boy.
It was that long ago. I just checked today.
Well, everybody's got their own schedules, you know.
And, you know, that's the way it goes when I start getting people booked in.
Yeah, yeah.
I have to go, oh, hey, by the way, I can get to you in the late summer of next year.
Of 2022.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's not a problem. I don't really have any obligations outside of work. So
cool.
It was my pleasure to be here.
All right. It was great having you. Do you want to leave any contact info? People want to get a hold of you?
I don't really have any.
Okay.
I'm on Facebook, so if people want to rag at me on there, they can do that. I'm easy enough to find if you can get the spelling of the last name right.
Excellent. Thanks again for doing this, and I'm sure we'll interact down the line.
I hope so.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Well, everyone, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Dave. I had a great time talking to him. If you would like to get a hold of me, you can do that feedback@hugospodcast.com, or you can go up to hugospodcast.com and fill out the contact form there. That's how Dave got a hold of me. That's how a lot of my guests get a hold of me. I am pretty full up on guests, but you know, it's never too early to claim a title. So if you want to guest in the future, it might be next year. But if you want to get your foot in the door and have me pencil you in for something, do go ahead and reach out to me. You can also follow me on Twitter @HugosPodcast. You can find the Facebook page, facebook.com/Hugo's Podcast. And if you would like to support the work that I do here, the work that I do on Take Me to Your Reader and Brief and Not So Brief, then you can go up to patreon.com/Hugo's Podcast and sign up to support for as little as $1 a month. I'm not yet to the level of support there where I pledged to start doing bonus episodes, but I do tend to post episodes there early. And, you know, once I get a few more patrons, then I'm going to have to start delivering on doing some Hugo winners of movies or television or novellas or short stories, that kind of stuff. And I think that's about everything. So thank you so much for listening. I really, really appreciate it. You know, the pandemic and the social distancing and that kind of stuff has not changed anything for this podcast because I'm always recording remotely. The only exceptions are the ones that I've done with Colin or James, who live in the same town as I do. So yeah, you should expect to continue hearing episodes here every month. I have no plans on slowing down my cadence because once a month is very doable. It's just a matter of my ability to find time to get the reading done. And I can do that. I believe in myself. So I will be back with another episode next month. And until then, again, thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.